meantime, let me just introduce our philosophy in doing these exercises. The aim of the whole exercise is, of course, to understand star formation. And the way we go about this is by making numerical experiments. Many properties of the interstellar medium in which stars are born are known quite well from observations. Others one can infer by doing a forward analysis. So you make a family of models with varying parameters, for example, Aldenic Mach number, so the ratio of kinetic energy to magnetic energy. And then you compare observation and diagnostics and see which one is consistent with observations and which one is not. Doing that, one may end up either with very well specified properties or with a range of possible properties. It turns out that the range is rather narrow, and one can then go ahead and use the models, look at them, look at the physics that go into them, and one has a terrible advantage compared to observers, because one has all the eight variables of the MHD equations in three dimensions and as a function of time. So one can actually now check what is the physics that causes certain properties. Okay, let's see if it comes up. And to summarize the main properties that we want to understand, a very fundamental one is the so-called initial mass function, the IMF, that describes the distribution of stars over mass. Yeah, that's it. Better. It has this stupid property I can't see both at once. Maybe I can now. It's a bit inconvenient otherwise.
The message that you don't have administrative rights.
Yeah, that's a funny one, because if you then say, don't show me this again, in order to enforce that, you have to have administrative rights. So it never works. It means you're not root on Windows NT. Oh, just a moment. Get to the beginning of this. Okay, so here we have the same picture that we looked at before on Monday last week. And this is very much a result of the efforts of Paolo Padoan, who was a PhD student in Copenhagen and is now at CFA. He will be here in a week or so, for a few days, or actually for a week or so. So he can answer for himself then. But I will go through these aspects of the physics of star formation. He has a very smart analytic model to come up with the same IMF that we find numerically, and we're still debating a bit whether that is the exact explanation for it or not. Parts of these things have been done together with other people listed here. So the thing I mentioned before is that our philosophy is this. The ultimate aim is to understand what's going on. And the big questions in this case is, how does it work, really? Is it gravitational instabilities? And what, if anything, does turbulence have to do with it? What determines the initial mass function? And is it generic? Does it differ in the early universe? Does it differ in star formation, in starburst galaxies, and so on? Number three, the star formation rate. What influences that? And how did it differ in the early universe? And as a sort of checkpoint here, I'm going to show you comparisons of properties of protostellar cores, because that's what starts the star formation, and that's how far we can follow it. We're making models on the scales of parsecs, so we can follow the evolution down to a fraction of a parsec. Another checkpoint here is looking at the properties of the interstellar medium and actually also deducing things that one cannot immediately see from observations. For example, what is its intermittency? And what possibly drives it? Is it the density waves of the galaxy, or is it stellar outflows, jets, or is it supernova? A classic problem is to understand Larson's relations. I'll show you on the next few Google graphs what that is, but it's a statistical relation between size, density, and velocity of structures in the interstellar medium. And it's been around for a number of years, and we really would like to understand why it's there. And to give you a quick summary of the answers that we come up with here, actually, we come up with answers to all these questions. We find that the properties of star formation are largely determined by properties of supersonic turbulence, and to a very small extent by self-gravity. That takes over at the end. But everything, including the IMF, is determined by supersonic turbulence. To a good approximation, the interstellar medium is isothermal, and that turns out to be a great thing because isothermal gas has very generic properties. Its density, for example, is log normal.
Do you call a factor of 10 to the fifth?
the cold stuff in the molecular clouds is even has a gamma less than one. When you compress it, it tends to cool. It has a very efficient cooling, and that's why it doesn't respond as a normal gas when you compress. And that's extremely important because since it doesn't, it means you can really push a clump over the edge and make it collapse. I come back to that. I'll also point to recent results that really the main driver of the interstellar medium is supernova. I'll illustrate that it's very intermittent, and I'll show you a number of observational diagnostics that really indicate without any doubt that the interstellar medium is superalvenic, meaning that the kinetic energy is larger than the magnetic energy on the small scales. I'll show you what Larson's relations come from, and I'll discuss star formation. Our discussion of star formation, our work on star formation, is very much inspired by Bruce Elmgren, who has come up with a number of very nice discussion papers. One, for example, says star formation in the crossing time from this year or last year. I really recommend it. Very nice. And as I said, we find that the star formation is totally controlled by the properties of turbulence, and that self-gravity comes in only at the end. We find an IMF in our numerical simulations that is totally consistent with the Salpeter IMF. And we come up with a scaling relation, or the dependency of star formation rate on basic properties. It depends on very few properties, actually. And we come up with a sequence of results for the stellar cores. So just very quickly, for non-astrophysics people, these are the properties of the interstellar medium that are significant for this discussion. The molecular clouds in which stars are formed have temperatures of the order of 10 Kelvin, maybe 30 Kelvin, maybe a few Kelvin, but very cold. And the sound speed then is of the order of a quarter of a kilometer per second. But the velocity dispersions one can measure are several kilometers per second, which shows beyond any possible doubt that this is strongly supersonic.
Oh, wait a minute. In cloud cores, they're sonic or subsonic?
Sorry?
The very places you're talking about, they're known to be sonic or subsonic.
Yeah, the cores. Yes, the cores. But this is the medium out of which the cores form.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I'll come to the. Yeah. You'll see that the cores are subsonic indeed. And all star formation takes place in these cold clouds. The two Larsen relations is a scaling of velocity dispersion with size, approximately of the form that the dispersion relation is about 1 km per second at 1 parsec, and scales as some exponent close to 0.4 with size. And the mean density is about 2,000 at 1 parsec, and scales inversely with the length. But these are very rough relations. I'll show you what they are, really, in the next one here.
When you use the term dispersion, what do you mean velocity dispersion? Do you mean the standard deviation?
Yes, something like that. Or you can measure line width, for example. That's also a measure of dispersion. So here you see that these are statistical relations. For example, the density as a function of size of structures. That's an enormous scatter, two orders of magnitude. But it has a rather well-defined envelope, at least. And it extends over so many orders of magnitude that it establishes itself as a reasonable scaling relation. And the velocity also extends over almost four orders of magnitude. Actually enough, and if you look a bit at this figure, you can see that it's not half. It's not one half. That would fit a little bit worse. And this line here is Kolmogorov one third. Doesn't fit quite either. So 0.4 is a good number. This is from a paper by Falgarone, Pouquet, and Perrault. I'm missing one other figure from that, and it's coming as a biograph.
I mean, you say it's not 1/3, but of course, in Kolmogorov turbulence, it is really actually 0.4, isn't it?
Well, okay. Sorry, no, it's not 0.4.
Theta 1.
Sorry?
Isn't it theta 1 what you're looking at? The velocity.
This is theoretically 1/3 if Kolmogorov scaling was correct, right? And the deviations from Kolmogorov are small compared to this deviation here. So this more has to do with the difference between normal turbulence and supersonic turbulence, and not with any deviations from Kolmogorov in ordinary turbulence. And just very quickly here to sort of set the scene here, here's a sequence of Hubble Space Telescope images of various nebulae. This is the Lagoon M8 and the Trifid Nebula.
The distinction between 0.4 and 1/2.
Sorry?
I would expect 1/2. I mean, can you really distinguish here? Guarantee that it's.
Yes, if you go back to the figure, I think you can. 1/2 would not fit so well. And also it's consistent with what we find from the simulations, so I don't doubt that it's...
What are you emphasizing by looking at these pictures?
Sorry?
What are you emphasizing by looking
at the picture?
I'm just showing beautiful pictures.
Oh, okay.
Just enjoy them. Now, really, I'm emphasizing how terribly complicated this situation is. For example, here we have something which is a star-forming cloud, and it's being evaporated by light from the outside. Some hot stars on the outside have turned on, and they're now quickly evaporating the cloud, quickly in terms of these evolution times. And these little things sticking out here is simply the result of more dense regions that survive a little bit longer. So if star formation takes place in these very complicated conditions, how can one ever hope to understand it quantitatively? And there's also another point here. I think I missed the biograph. Okay. Namely that these conditions are terribly, terribly different from what you learned about in the textbooks, which is the old fairy tale about genes instability. So this is the theory where you compare the free fall gravitational free fall time, which scales as 1 over the density to 1 over the density square root, and the sun crossing time. And that would tell you when a quiescent uniform cloud with a small perturbation, when it collapses. The critical length then is the so-called Jeans length, and that corresponds to a particular mass, the Jeans mass. And this turns out to be totally irrelevant in the interstellar medium, because if this was the story then all of these clouds could just collapse in short order, and you'd have much heavier and much more efficient star formation than you really have. So what's wrong with it? Well, it's comparing thermal energies and gravitational energies. But that's nuts, because the kinetic energies are 10 to 100 times larger. We know that because it's supersonic. So the typical Mach numbers are from a few to 10 or 15. And therefore the kinetic energies is surely a much more important player than the thermal energy. Well, that's another very interesting aspect. For a long, long time, it's been assumed, without any particular evidence, that the magnetic field has been of the order is of the order of the kinetic energy, and that would then be the agent that stops or halts star formation. Because the problem has been that star formation was thought to be should be more efficient. It was much more inefficient than one with simple reasoning could argue that it should be. So one has thought means to lower the efficiency. And magnetic field was advocated as one reason, and it's not the reason. So let's look briefly at the properties of supersonic turbulence. It has a log normal density PDF for isothermal conditions. And this is very important because it means that it's very intermittent. The width, the dispersion of density, of linear density, is equal to half the root mean square Mach number. And that means that for typical Mach numbers, like for example here, you have Mach numbers of 1.5, 2.5, and 5, you find an enormous range of densities. And if you look at the log density, of course, you find that it spans over 4 orders of magnitude. And stars are formed here, out on the edge. Okay, and you pack things together to a much higher density than the mean density. So this is rho over mean rho. And our method now is to take supersonic turbulence simulations and scale them. We want to have something which is 15 parsec in box size. We know that we should have something like a Mach number of 10. And we know what the mean rho should be interpreted as being. But the mean rho doesn't appear in the equations otherwise. The equations are totally independent of mean rho. And that is indeed why the PDF is log normal, which I can show by just looking at the equations of motion, the equation of motion and the equation for density, the continuity equation. For an isothermal gas, these equations are totally independent of mean density. You can shift the mean density with a factor of 1,000 and nothing happens to the response to a gas to a particular force pattern. If the force pattern is per unit mass, then exactly the same thing happens independent of mean density. And that can be used using a statement, a theorem by Pope and Ching, that simply express the PDF in a way so that you can use that expression from this point of view.
I must admit, I'm completely lost by what you just said.
Okay.
Can you explain that again?
Yes. I should explain it on the blackboard. But I won't take too much time on it. So normally one writes the continuity equation as d rho dt is minus u dot grad rho minus dv. Okay. But it can also be rewritten as d ln rho dt is equal to minus u dot grad ln rho minus rho dv, like so. The equation of motion, likewise, can be rewritten as du dt is minus u dot grad u. And then usually you have 1 over rho grad p. But we write that as p over rho grad ln p. And this one can again write as grad ln rho plus p over rho. us, log. And P over rho is a constant because that's the temperature, no? And it's constant, so it drops out. And therefore again, and then you have the external force.
Yeah, but the external force is rho squared.
Well, you know, it can be anything. No? We need to have an external force to drive this medium, and you can think of...
if you don't talk about star formation, gravitation, which is not proportional to rho, Q and
V. Okay, drop it out. This makes it easier. But if it's there, if it's there, it has to be independent of density, okay? Because look now at these two equations. If it's isothermal, there is no third equation, okay? So if I make the transformation now, rho goes from rho to rho times c, well, you know, all that happens is that ln rho goes to ln rho plus a constant. And the same thing still works, huh? Nothing changes here. A particular F pattern will produce exactly the same U.
Yeah, but nature doesn't operate that way. What's happening is self-gravity. The thing that forms stars is self-gravitation.
Yes, in the end. Be patient. I come to it.
What?
Be patient. I will come to it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that's what we normally would argue that.
Yes.
Yes. We want to argue that we are in an inertial range. And when we look at one section of the inertial range, we necessarily have to force. And we have to dissipate at the other end. But in real life, this is a section of a larger cascade. So our forcing really is the cascade from larger scales. Sure, that's right. So I don't think I should go through this.
What you explained was the bit that I understood.
Okay.
What I don't understand is what does that have to do with log normal distribution?
If one looks at that paper by Pope and Ching, they have a formula which HTML is not very good at formula, yeah? But it's something like. The probability distribution function can be written as some kind of a normalization constant over q of x, p of x, and then some integral of something like r of x prime dx prime, and there are some other factors too, where q of x is the conditional probability. And r is the same thing with the acceleration. So if one has a statistical variable x here, then q measures its speed, conditioned on where you measure. Okay? How quickly does it change, depending on where you measure. And this one measures the acceleration, the second time derivative. And these come into the formula in such a way that if this is constant and that is linear, you get a log normal. Okay? It's purely mathematical. It has nothing to do with anything, astrophysics or anything. That's a proof mathematically. But here it can be used, because we can show that since the dynamics doesn't depend on mean density, this must be independent of what level you look at, and therefore it's constant. Huh? And in the same way, you can show that this one is linear, and that's sort of how it relates to a much more simple way to argue, which others have done in the past, is to say that when things don't depend on density, then you have a chain of multiplicative changes of density, okay? When you have multiplicative changes that are statistically independent, then the central limit theorem gives you a normal distribution of log, okay, in this case, because log becomes additive when density is multiplicative. Huh? So in practice, you have a series of shocks. Shocks going through the medium, and the shocks will jump the density at some particular value.
Would you say that multiplying random numbers, is that because hypothetically you would have log normal distribution, but this is not a special
distribution. No, no, and the amazing thing is how quickly this thing goes to log normal on one side. Ah, I didn't include that figure, but there's another talk available on the web where I show that the high density side of this PDF is established surprisingly quickly. You know? In just one turnover time, you have this high density side, whereas the other side takes much longer to develop.
It's very sensitive to whether you put magnetic fields in or not.
To some extent, because if you up the magnetic field sufficiently, so it starts to become dynamically important, then you kill this. You make it smaller. You reduce the width. You reduce the width so it no longer is equal to half the Mach number. But it's smaller, and then eventually it's killed totally.
And is the pop chain derivation the supersonic turbulence?
No, it's just a mathematical proof. It has nothing to do with. But as I will argue, it is actually very fortunate that this is so quick, because by Bruce Elmgren's argument, star formation takes place in a turnover time. So if this was just a statistical result in the long term, it would be totally uninteresting from the point of view of star formation. These two are just a curious result. If you take two points on the PDF, say over here and over here, are totally symmetric, they have the same number of voxels in 3D space, and you look at what the isosurface looks like, they're totally different. This is the high side PDF, and it consists, of course, of sheets and filaments and knots, because it's collisions of shocks. But the low density side consists of voids, so it's sort of more triangular and like intersections of voids. And still they have exactly the same volume, and they're symmetric with respect to the PDF, so that's funny. Something very peculiar happens with the power scaling here. First of all, even highly supersonic turbulence like Mach 15 or whatever has power laws. They're slightly steeper, 1.8 maybe. We have only 128 cubes, so we can't really tell the difference between 1.8 and 2 or so. But the significant thing is that the power law of kinetic energy, which is now not the same as the power for U2, because you have rho, and rho is very intermittent, remember, is significantly different. It has an index of between 1.3 and 1.5, whereas U2 and B2 has an index of 1.8 to 2. So there is a difference. And that means that if you have a competition on the large scale, say on galactic arm scales, then you develop a gap. If you go two orders of magnitude down, you develop a gap of one order of magnitude. And that's exactly what we find is consistent with observations. There is a gap of one order of magnitude in kinetic energy relative to B.
So B is just a passive scalar here, is that all you do?
Passive vector, yes. Passive vector. Seems to be that. But it may be still quite important. As I show you, it too is very intermittent.
Are you going to tell us how much of that energy spectrum is rotational and how much is...
Yes, I was going to make a figure about that, but I didn't have quite the time. I was doing some other figures that took longer than I thought. But as far as I recall, it's about 3/4 which is in rotational and 1/4 or so in compressional. And when you think about it, it's not so strange, because in 3D, when you have shocks, you don't have them head on. It's more like colliding... inclined shocks, generating a lot of vorticity. I'll show you a rendering of vorticity to make Bob happy. I have one. And very briefly, I'll just point your attention to a paper by Corpi and Brandenburg and Company in APJ, was it last year? Probably. And there's a master thesis available on the web too that investigates the same thing. Namely, can you show a consistency if you assume a reasonable supernova rate, like one every 30 or 50 years, and use that as the sole driver of the medium? And the answer, briefly, is yes. You can find things like the vertical property, vertical properties of the disk are consistent, the amplitude of motions are consistent, and so undoubtedly the supernova energy input is the main driver of the interstellar medium, and it's what sits at the top of these power laws. Huh? There must be something that feeds energy into the power laws, and when we look at the interstellar medium on a parsec scale, we shouldn't worry about the driving of it, because the driving is there. It simply is the motions coming from larger scales. Huh? So at that top sits the supernova. Okay, just very briefly a number of forward comparisons that we made. One looks at extinction and the scatter of extinction as a function of extinction. One can compare with some papers by Lada and Lada, and one finds that in a supersonic medium, one does develop automatically a large spread. We can't go as far in Mach number as the real interstellar medium can, but one gets about the same behavior. Whereas if one does it for... so this is the simulation with supragravitonic conditions, and this is the simulation with...
Can you explain distinction statistics?
Yes. You have a gas cloud, which is not totally opaque. And then you have some field stars behind. And you look at their extinction. So you measure the extinction of a large number of background stars. And then you compute in small boxes the spread of extinction. So how much does one star and its neighbor differ in extinction? And you really expect in a homogeneous medium that would be more or less the same. But here, they can differ very much. This is in magnitudes. And the difference increases with extinction itself. And that's exactly what we find when we do the same thing with the data set, the data cubes. If we do it with competition models, we don't get that at all, because when the magnetic field is there, it prevents the intermittency. Another very strong diagnostic is the BN relation. This is a relation over about 10 or 11 orders of magnitude between the peak magnetic field that one finds in various structures and their density. And it goes something like B to the 0.4 or so. And we can reproduce that over a limited interval, of course.
But do you mean density 0.4?
Excuse me?
Much lower densities than is actually observed. I mean, the scaling of field strength with density in the weak means with low alpha Mach number occurs at low densities, whereas the observation has a scaling at high densities.
No. These are observations all the way. These are observations here. The whole thing here is established observationally.
I think the scaling really begins at densities above 100 particles per centimeter cubed.
Maybe not.
Well, below that it's fairly constant, a few micrograms.
Doesn't seem to be from what we've gathered from the literature. And particularly when you talk to observers privately, there are lots of upper limits. Lots of non-observations that people never mention in the papers. And what we emphasize here is not just this envelope, but also that this is only an envelope. And you find a huge scatter of magnetic field strength. There are upper limits down here. 1.5 order of magnitude below the envelope. And that is a real scatter, which we also find in the simulations. And I'll show you some more of that later on. So this becomes consistent if we have supragravitonic conditions, but it's not consistent if we have equipartition values.
So the physics behind this scatter is that the regions that are compressed are not necessarily magnetically compressed?
No. Yes. It means that when a region is compressed, the amount of magnetic field that it gets is a function of how much happens to be in the neighborhood. If it happens to catch a big chunk and compresses it, you get a very high field. But if it happens to get it in the wrong angle or in a weak field region, because the field is also becoming very intermittent, and therefore there are huge voids with very weak field strength.
The but you have all this rotational turbulence. If you just wait in the simulation, then the field strength will grow.
By dynamo effects?
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. But we don't actually find it in the simulation so far. Even though at 1.3 cube we find, you know, it's easy to find a dynamo effect in subsonic turbulence at 50 cube, no problem. But 128 cube subsonically we don't find it yet. I think the reason is that the gas, the heavy gas, where the field sits, is moving rather slowly. So the effective Reynolds number is not very high.
It's rotating at all. When you compress it, it rotates faster.
Rotates faster.
I feel we get stronger and stronger.
Well, maybe, but we also have observation constraints to satisfy. That the cores that are formed are found to have strong fields, but not terribly strong fields. There is a relation that we can satisfy, and it doesn't seem that a dynamo effect is really much necessary to satisfy that. You can take the average field, and this intermittency thing will do it for you. So here's just a sequence of other diagnostics I don't have really any reason to go into, but they all indicate the same thing, that you get consistency with supraalgenic conditions and not consistency with ecbertician conditions.
Okay, earlier you said something about completing the magnetic field as a passive tracer. Is that it's just some of your simulations? And
no, we have a bunch of simulations all the way from super ecbertition down to very weak fields. But we all...
Yes,
we do. We just have a bunch of parameters. So let me go to this one. This one is really a neat one. It may take a little bit too much of explaining, but it is a relation between the velocity of the dispersion and a measure of the local density, measured by an integration of antenna temperature times over velocity. And the red dots are from the model, the blue dots are observations from the Perseus cloud. There is no way, absolutely no way, you can get this if the structure is not very intermittent and if it is not created by shocks. There's no doubt that the interstellar medium's structure is created by shocks. And you know, at that level, self-gravity is still not very interesting. And here's another comparison, which I need to compare with that U-graph I thought would... I'll just go on and ask why wait. This is a very neat and crucial one, absolutely crucial. So let's look at it carefully. Here we have from the same paper by Falgarone, Pugui, and Perrault. Pugui. Sorry. Let's see. Where's the focus on this one below here? Okay. Here we have something similar to the dynamic pressure. Okay. Number density times velocity dispersion squared.
This is for a whole bunch of clouds.
Yes. This is for a number of different complexes of clouds. Many, many observations gathered together in one. And here's the against density. And by Larson's relations, you expect this to be flat. Okay, that's what they say. The way density scales as 1 over L, okay, and this scales as L to the 1/2. So this ought to be constant. And it is, you know, it's constant. Like that. Yes. In the same sense that Larson relations hold. But that's not the point. The point here is that for any individual cloud, you have a very strong relation. Very tight. Here's one cloud, or one complex. Here's another one. All of them have very tight local correlations. How can that be? How can that be?
It seems to a first approximation that the correlation is that delta B squared equals constant. You're plotting
n. No, it's not. No, it really, they claim in the paper that it's the power of 2. Okay? I think it's more like 1.5. Huh? But it's not.
What I'm saying is that the axis is a priori correlated with the ordinary.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Put a line through here. Huh? That's slope 1. You can clearly see that this is about twice that slope. Huh?
Okay.
Pull a line through here and you got something like 3 or 4 orders of magnitude over 6. Huh? So it's not the constant delta V squared. But there is a genuine relation. Huh? And indeed, when I do the same thing with a data cube, I have 128 cubed points. Huh? And now I collect them together into 16 by 16 by 16 sub-volumes. So there are 8 by 8 by 8 of those. Huh? And for each one of them, I compute the mean density and rho v squared. I find exactly the same relation. Okay? So that's what you get for one piece of supersonic turbulence, has that. Huh? And you can argue about the reasons. I think the reason basically is that when you go from high density to low density, I know that the PDF is developed by first compressing things, and then I see a pulse going to lower density. That means expanding motions. Huh? So even if you have high vorticity on a small scale, when you expand that blob, of course, its velocity dispersion decreases. Huh? So therefore, the low density stuff has low velocity dispersion. It's perfectly curious that if you take something very similar, namely the velocity dispersion conditioned on density, okay, it's not quite the same. With IDL, for example, you can select all points in space that have the same density or in some interval of density. We have an opposite relation. So.
That's the problem about the shock waves. I mean, normally I would have thought that it's very difficult under molecular cloud conditions to follow the details of an isothermal shock, which is magnetized. The damn field is going to be very dense.
Yes.
Another shock is going to
yes.
come and hit it, et cetera, et cetera. And to make sure that flux
exactly.
conservation is conserved, it is preserved.
This is how a typical core looks like. Huh?
Okay.
Right? And the velocity does this. Huh? The core is formed by sort of an extrusion in velocity, larger than normal velocity. It creates a slightly stronger jump in density along this sheet. Huh? Typically, you find you have a bunch of intersections of sheets if you make a cut through your density field. I'll show you one live in a moment. Shocks are all over the place here. I'll show you.
Following each one in extraordinary detail, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you mean extraordinary?
Well, we have
sure.
we have flux conservation. We have the
1/100th of the or less of the box size, right? So you're talking
yes.
about small fractions of a parsec.
Yes.
And these things are colliding
yes.
with each other.
But we have control.
I'd like to see the methodology.
We have control over when things go bad. Because when things go bad, you can see that the log normal is not quite filled up here. Huh? So when you increase the Mach number, eventually you get to a point where with that resolution, you can no longer resolve the highest densities. Huh? And note that this is a curious and very fortunate reduction of difficulty. Normally in 1D shocks and isothermal conditions, density jumps with Mach squared. Okay? But here we find that the log normal scales with Mach number. So it becomes intermittent but not extremely intermittent. If it went like Mach squared, then we couldn't follow it with current resolutions. So that's sort of fortunate.
Sorry, I missed the point.
From
why
our point of view.
Why is it M rather than M squared?
Because this is 3D and things tend to miss each other. Huh? You don't have head-on collisions. Huh?
In any one shot, then you're still M squared. Right?
Yes, yes. For the perpendicular component, yes. Still M squared for the perpendicular component. Okay, well, before I go to actual data demonstration, let me show the IMF that develops from this. And in order to measure the IMF, one has to go through some technicalities. Because if you just take a constant level of density and you ask, you know, how many clumps do you find there? Well, here, you get one or three or two or three. Even though you can see with the eye that there's actually five. Huh? And it was shown a long time ago, 20 years ago, that you really don't need much density contrast for things to collapse individually under self-gravity. You know? So we have in the final analysis a density contrast limit of 2.5%. And to some extent our slope is dependent somewhat on that density contrast. But with that choice, at least we can get excellent consistency with the observed IMF. Because many, many observations now have established that the IMF has a power law behavior with an exponent of about 1.35, varying between 1.5 perhaps and 1.3. There's a cutoff at sub-solar size masses. And we get exactly that by combining two data sets, one for a large-scale experiment and one for a small-scale experiment. Yes. By looking at successive levels of density, there is an ideal function that returns the object, the connected object, that fulfills that criterion, for example, density higher than that limit. This is a procedure that the Powler wrote. So you first get yourself a list of those objects. And then you eliminate those that are sub-objects. So if you have two higher up-lying objects that are part of the same, you only keep the lower one.
So each connected object, you merge them at the largest scale.
Yes. And that produces surprisingly large number of objects in these data sets, because if you look at the initial figure here, this is probably a data set of the same type that we're looking at now. And there we had chosen one particular density, a high level, and all you find is, you know, half a dozen of objects or so. But the trick is that if you go down in density, you find lots and lots of local maxima, like here. And now I think it's time to show you the real data set here. Because of the slow startup here, I should have prepared this in advance. But
could you say again what your criterion is for forming stars? You said something about delta rho over rho being above.
This is for distinguishing between individual ones. But then the cutoff comes from when is the object no longer larger than its genes mass, or when is it not larger than its critical mass for magnetic fields. So the first flattening comes from magnetic fields, and the next one comes from the genes mass. So that's where the genes mass comes in, but not before that. Okay, so I need to get this.
I'm afraid, can you explain that again? Because it seems like I should really understand that. Can you explain just again what you do?
Yes. Yeah, just a moment. I need to find a procedure or whatever. This one. Okay. So while this is loading, I might as well. Exactly. And that's the crucial point. Is that a valid assumption or not? Is that a dangerous assumption? And the last piece of this talk addresses exactly that question. But first let me show you
since I don't know what the assumption is, I'm not sure if I know, can judge if it's dangerous.
Well, the assumption is that you can find individual clumps as local maxima. Searching with a search algorithm, far below the absolute maximum of density. So you have a local maximum which is at least 2.5% larger than its nearest valley. And you say that will self-collapse if its mass is larger than its genes mass. It seems like a good assumption, because those local maxima are formed by compressions that halt the motion. So in the local frame of reference, there is no more turbulence. But you have compressed it, and if that is now gravitationally unstable, it will collapse.
And how much would you do to figure out how big such a local maximum is? Like, you find the place where you have a local maximum, to get the total mass, you would have to
find the mass.
And this is all so simple with IDL. You can actually do it short. I could show you the procedure, but it doesn't take much. You can just add it up, and you know, Axel can assure you that these things can be done in IDL. So in order to visualize...
You've got some local maximum in the density, right? Where do you say is the mass within this? How big is the thing that you integrate over to say there's a mass?
Well, you get a list of indices, okay? That the center of gravity is its center. And the root mean square of its deviation from the center is its radius, or its size. So you can make plots of size simply that way.
The root mean square.
You find the center of gravity. You have a number of points nearby, which is a list of coordinates.
Yeah.
And the distances from that, the root mean square of that, is some kind of a measure of the size.
So the cutoff depends, of course, then on the mass that you have reached by that point. Is that right?
Have you followed these little things to collapse?
No.
So how do you know that they won't disappear by just dynamical interactions? I mean, these could be wave-like structures that could disappear before
they collapse. They are gravitationally unstable, and they don't have enough turbulence in them to support. So that they are now you've formed them.
How big size are these objects?
Sorry?
How big are these objects numerically?
From a few to 10. Grids?
I would say anything under 5 is questionable.
Perhaps, but let me show the statistics of them. First of all, here is a visualization of the vorticity. And notice that even if you go to the highest values of vorticity, you never find tubes. You always find sheets. And that's characteristic of supersonic turbulence, because you cannot make a vortex tube in supersonic turbulence. You cannot have something spinning around at supersonic speeds. But you form vorticity by colliding by making an inclined shock. So now Bob is only left. I have to show it to him afterwards.
That's vorticity, then.
This is vorticity. And let me show you one cut through in density.
Those little striations and everything, are they real, or is that...?
They are simply at the resolution limit. You're seeing the grid when you're visualizing. That always happens when you do isosurfaces, when you have thin structures.
Also, shear layers that form at intersecting shocks always...
Now I need to...
Their roll-up is dependent on the grid scale.
In other words, they're truly subjugated.
Yes, they have to be, because the shocks are the thickness of the grid size, because there's no viscosity that's going to resolve the shock at these Reynolds limits. So I can show you lots of examples. The shear layers that form at triple points or intersecting shocks are always at the grid size. Their role is determined by the grid scale.
Well, of course. I mean, it depends on what numerical viscosity you choose. We have to have something that smooths out things over one or two grids. So things do not get under-resolved. So that's what a shock size is here. Let's see, I need to have decompose equals zero and window. And okay, so this is a visualization, a cut of log rho. And that's cheating a bit, because really if you look at rho, this is what it looks like. And just to make things a bit more visible, let's take rho to the 0.2, or maybe 0.3 or something. Oh, 0.2 is fine. And then let's scan through here. So that's rho. And we do for I equals 0, 1, 27. Image comma R. So that's rho itself, scanning through a delta cube. Sorry. And what is not quite obvious here, but is more obvious when you do the R to the 0.2, is that this is really hierarchical in density. That web in the middle here is stuff that has already been shocked and is now being shocked again, or shocks are passing through it. So let me just do this to 0.2 to increase the contrast, and just every second one, like so. So you see this region here has a considerably larger density on the average than here outside, very much lower. So that stuff has already been scooped up by previous shocks and is now undergoing internal shocking.
You have a part of the magnetic field?
So now, you want to see the magnetic field?
If others don't mind.
I vote for a chip.
Okay. Well, you need to see the absolute value then. So I have to do a little bit of typing here. Comma 5, that's bx squared. Plus star, comma 5, comma 6, that's by. And then we probably want to have the whole thing raised to some power like open file. Now this will be the B itself. It's a bit slow, of course, because it's now computing for 3 full data cubes. So.
Oh, this
is the magnitude of B. Yes. And you see, it looks very much like the magnitude of density. That's because you scoop up the field too. It tends to get. Sorry?
The initial value of beta.
Let's see. It's 1/10.
Beta.
Yes. 1/10 or else 1/30. 1 or 1.5 order of magnitude difference.
So
the
field is strong compared to the sun speed.
Sorry?
So the A is large compared to the sun speed.
Yes. The A is strong compared to the sun speed. Yes, that's true. Okay, back to the exposition here. You see, this is a snapshot of the same thing. And if you look at the magnetic field, it sits in those filaments. Like so. It's forced to be more or less aligned with these filaments, and it's compressed into them. Of course, there's some B field in the rest of the volume too. And now let me just summarize here by looking at these protostellar cores.
This rotation? Well, you said there's a lot of rotational energy.
Yes, if you measure the rotational component, it's larger than the compressional one. Might not be obvious from just a snapshot, but it's there.
But you have a lot of vorticity in these big shapes. Something about these filaments is a big shear across them.
But I need to finish this up. So the crucial question now, is this a valid selection of stellar cores, of protostellar cores? And to investigate that question, one can, again, take the same path. One compares the properties of these cores with the extensive databases that exist of the properties of stellar cores. And one finds that they're consistent on everything we've looked at. Radii, aspect ratios, masses, velocity dispersion. And here's your question about the velocities of these cores. That's the answer to that, if I can get it up. Okay. Here are the velocity dispersions in the cores. Okay. They're of the order of the sound speed. Sorry? Okay. Yes. The rotational velocities of the cores are also of the order of the sound speed. And independent of the core size, which is very interesting and very crucial for the ability of these cores to form large mass stars. This has been considered a major problem in the past. How do you at all form large high mass stars? They were thought to have too much rotation to start with. But the way that works is the other way around, that the cores that have a lot of mass, they formed exactly because they had a low angular momentum. That was the only way you could actually compress them. And therefore they're born with a very low angular momentum, and they can collapse to massive stars pronto, without really the problem with an extensive accretion disk phase. So that property is consistent. The surface density of these cores are consistent with observations. The distribution of magnetic field strength, even though the mean field here is only 3 microgauss, huh? Look, you can find cores all the way up to over 80 microgauss.
Do you mean observationally or theoretically? I'm not sure what theory.
Well, they're consistent. This is exactly... These are from the data cubes, huh? But this is again consistent with observations. Huh?
Well, that's an interesting point, because the observations, the way that they're sometimes cast, suggest the power law. If you take that, you had indicated that they would be proportional to the square root of the density relationship earlier. If you take that as not an upper limit, but as a characteristic magnitude, then the observations wouldn't be consistent with the next.
No, but no. But there's a difference between doing that and taking a PDF.
The height values of magnetic fields. Surely the magnetic field play a dynamic role.
Yes, it will be dynamically important in some cores. That's true. Even though it's subalbenic. And that is indeed the reason why the IMF flattens out. This IMF again is from experiments with about the same beta, and this part of the flattening is due to the criterion. You can see here in that region the masses are smaller than the critical mass and you don't get collapse. So the avoidance of this corner here is due to that.
Could you explain that bottom graph there? The vertical plot is the mass associated with what?
The mass of the core against its magnetic field. So this is a scatter. These are all the cores that came out of this extraction.
That seems paradoxical to me, because the field strength tends to be weaker in the larger structures. At least that was what I thought was the normal understanding of cloud complex. The field strength would be strongest in the smallest structures, which certainly have less mass.
No, in the small structures that are dense, in the dense small structures.
He's already selected for density.
Exactly.
You're speaking of only the density peaks. Okay. Is that correct?
Sorry?
You're already picking out the densest peaks.
Yes.
You're only discussing
that. These are statistics of the course.
Yeah.
But for all that we can judge by looking at these forward comparisons, that course selection procedure seems to be valid. No? And therefore, we do believe that when we go now back to look at the dynamics that creates this IMF, we're looking at the real process and not just some fake. Just very briefly as a parenthesis, the fact that the IMF is steeper than minus one means that it's not totally self-similar. If it was self-similar, you would have a minus one slope. But here, it forms slightly larger numbers of small stars. There's slightly more mass per unit logarithmic interval in small stars than for large stars. Right? And the reason for that is that at lower Mach numbers, you tend to form more structures. If you count the number of structures in the box, it is larger at low Mach numbers. So it's simply the scaling of Mach number with size, one of the Larson's relations, that creates that skewness. So if we sum up this now, the important results that have been found is that the interstellar medium is extremely intermittent because it's an approximately log normal distribution. Of course, the real medium is not isothermal. so it doesn't have a perfect log normal. But you can impress by saying that the range in density must be similar as to an isotherm in TDR. And star formation seems to happen in the way Bruce Almgren has suggested, in a crossing time, immediately. There are very strong evidence for that observationally too. And the reason that it is so inefficient is that it involves only a fraction of the mass. There's only a fraction of the mass that gets compressed enough to become stars. So turbulence has its way, forms the structures, and out pops the stars, frozen out by gravity. But there's still a lot of mass left to be blown out by the first supernova. Okay.
I'm just worried that if you get some running into the magnetic field will build up and build up, and you ended up with what do you call it when V squared is equal to V squared? You call it super equal partition or something. You've got this rotational turbulence, you've got this magnetic field that's well below the partition.
Yes, but you must remember that it's a very peculiar form of turbulence, where most of space... Yes, it is. Most of space has very little mass, very little density, and very little handle on the magnetic field. And there's only this tiny fraction of the volume, a few percent, that really has a handle on the field.
Yeah, and that's where all the vorticity is. You're saying you get the same. He suggested you wouldn't get the same answer if you started with
V squared equals V squared.
My intuition is that if you went now to 256 cubed or 512 cubed, then yes, you would have some build-up of magnetic energy because you were now twisting things along these filaments, and you were able to resolve that twist. There is a strong vortical component near these sheets and filaments. So surely you would have some twisting on the field lines. But
I'm also worried, though, that your resolution is such that where you have all the vorticity is right at the grid scale, and that's where you have all the dissipation, which will clearly be your numerical resistivity, too.
Yes, I mean, you're welcome to redo it in 512 cube. You have the resources, huh?
I don't know.
No, but to finish my argument, my intuitive feeling here is that when you start twisting up the field along these filaments, we pretty soon get to the limit I talked about in the other connection, where when you have just one turn of twist, you get a kink instability that quickly dissipates anything above one turn. So that limits how much of phi component you can add to the energy. In other words, if the phi component would be much larger than the longitudinal component, you would have all kinds of violent instabilities that would quickly take it out. So I think you get some increase of the mean magnetic energy, but not a cascading growth to equipartition.
How far below equipartition are you in these simulations?
About a factor of 10 in energy. And that seems to be the right level, because you need to match these observations, of course.
And the same condition which puzzles me about it. So you talk about the simulation with the 3 microgal magnetic field. So that's roughly the field of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we know that giant molecular clouds are maybe 40 times denser than the average gas density. So if you smooth out all the structure in the molecular cloud, you have a density of maybe 40. Okay. So how does that form? That formed by some kind of condensation process. So, in order for that not to feel stronger, that condensation process would have had to be sort of collimated along the field. But if the field is that weak, I don't see how it can collimate the condensation process. So, if the condensation is isotropic, then you should have a stronger field.
So I don't know how to resolve this. How you get the field to be so weak in the first place?
Well, you can look at that both empirical and numerical relation between B and M. B doesn't grow that quickly. It doesn't grow as it does in the simple reasoning.
It
goes only as n to the 0.4.
This is before you have an isothermal supersonic turbulent cloud. This is when you're accumulating the thing in the first place. And my question is, how can you make a giant molecular cloud where the magnetic field is not much stronger than the average galactic field, unless the field is already strong in the first place?
Well, you're suggesting that it is strong in the beta, right? So it is strong in one sense. It's just whatever comes along to stir it up.
Well, what you're like again is not strong compared to the velocity of dispersion you might
have. Look. I mean, these are the actual observations of B.
But it's strong compared to the thermal pressure.
These are the actual observations of B. We've done nothing else. We've done nothing else than to normalize our parameters, our initial B0. But you're misunderstanding. Ellen, you're misunderstanding. You think that we chose B0 equals 3 micrograms because that's the average field in the galaxy. No. We normalize so that we get a good correspondence here. So it shows reversely that if you want to be consistent with observations, the average field our largest models are 15 parsecs. So by the Larson relation, the density is of the order of 100. Okay? So we would conclude that on the density level of about 100, the mean field is about 3 micrograms. About 3 micrograms. And remember that these observations are very difficult. So when you say that the field is maybe 3 or maybe 5, you're referring to some kind of a funny average in an extremely intermittent medium. You're not referring to...
The way that you're normalizing, the reason that the field is dropping the density like that is because the field has been gathered away from some voids. And you can't really match the field strength in the general ISM with the field strength in an isothermal
You're talking about the warm medium outside?
Yes, that's where the field is 3 micrograms. So if you try to put this cloud in the general ISM, you would have a pressure. I don't think you can normalize in the sense that you're suggesting.
I don't think that is an inconsistency there.
Getting pressures by just about doubling. B goes right through too, right?
The point is that the regions where you have a weak field and low density simulations are regions where you've made a void.
But remember,
very low pressures.
Remember that the result of the power indices are exactly consistent with having equipartition on the large scale. Okay? You develop a difference from the power indices between the kinetic energy and the magnetic energy.
Wait, you know, you seem to be saying two things. When you said before, the magnetic energy was about a factor of 10 smaller than the kinetic energy, but you just said that on the largest scale, the two energies are equal.
Yes. Roughly equal. I don't know how precise these measurements are, but you know, when people estimate the pressure balance of the galactic disk, they tend to say there are equal contributions from dynamic pressure, magnetic pressure, and cosmic rays.
But so you're saying from your simulations, if you extrapolate to larger scales, you would obtain equipartition at 40 parsecs, or something larger than your box, or what?
Two orders of magnitude larger than 10, so 1,000, 1 kiloparsec or something.
Sorry, I guess just to follow up on this, so in what sense is there not equal partition? In other words, if most of the energy is contained on the largest scale, I guess that's the intuition. If it's on the largest scale, then if you average over all scales, you expect more or less an average B squared is equal to which B. In what sense is there a factor of 10 difference between the magnetic energy,
there's a factor of 10 difference between the average magnetic
energy square, magnetic energy in the cloud and B square. I mean, this is basically all just a picture, I mean, the interpretation of the power spectrum that you explained earlier. You have a power spectrum where the kinetic energy is shallower than magnetic energy. And so as you go across the smaller scales, you will have less magnetic energy than kinetic energy. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay. So at large scales, there are equal positions.
So if these are the energy containment scales, say at 1 kiloparsec.
But, you might have problems of extrapolating up to 1 kiloparsec from your...
I'm not extrapolating, I'm just saying that if they are equal there, then they would be consistent with the factor of 10 difference where I'm worried about.
I'm saying that between a scale of 1 kiloparsec in your cloud, I don't think you would expect the difference in exponents, namely because you don't have such compressibility. The Mach number is lower.
No.
In the diffuse size.
No, the Mach number is higher. The Mach number grows with size.
In the diffuse ISM?
He's never mentioned the diffuse ISM, which is 90% of the ISM. 90% of the volume.
Excellent. You must know something about this from the from Marit's simulations. We have the actual RMS velocities, for example, for the various components.
Yeah, but we're talking about the mid-plane now.
Oh. Yes. We can go back and look at the actual RMS velocities for the warm component and for the hot component. We have them in our simulations, in different simulations.
I would just think that you might want to look at getting equipartition at a 40 parsec scale and see what the consequences are from that.
But actually, if I understood what he was doing, he was normalizing by the oscillation. He was normalizing by this diagram. Is that correct? He wasn't asking what's happening at larger scales than he was computing. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So that's fair, isn't it?
Well, I guess it
does. It's fair enough to normalize an observation, though.
Well, I guess from this plot here, it's not clear to me that this plot rules out data, that this plot rules out equipartition on a 40 parsec scale. It's known that these measurements of field strengths in clouds are not very good. They're not very complete. A lot of non-detections and it's a bit sketchy. So you might still want to consider the equipartition at the cloud scale for the reasons that Alan was raising.
But I can show you 6 different diagnostics that become inconsistent if I choose the competition values. There's no way you can make them fit. Everything becomes turned upside down. Nothing fits.
Nothing fits the high end of that large end of that scaling.
Nothing fits molecular lines, ratios. Nothing fits the velocity antenna temperature relation. These pictures becoming inconsistent with observations. This line ratio becomes inconsistent. No. Everything here becomes inconsistent if you assume a competition.
Very amusing because it's a huge industry, as you know, of trying to explain all kinds of things about star formation with a magnetic field.
Yes.
Is that right? I mean, honestly,
yeah.
If you're right, that's all wrong.
They have a problem, yes.
I guess I don't agree with everything being inconsistent. We haven't done some of these diagnostics, but the ones we have done, we don't find that inconsistent with a larger field strength.
Mm-hmm.
You also said something about magnetic braking being unimportant for forming stars because the structures which go genes unstable has such little angular momentum. Did you mean you needed
No. Magnetic braking is not totally insignificant. It is there. And it also actually seems to be influencing the IMF somewhat.
It does. That didn't come through what you said.
Okay, I showed it before. Actually, Paolo's plot for this is better because he has this labeled in the IMF from his talk. But as far as I remember, this piece here, this flattening here, the first flattening is due to the magnetic condition, and this one is due to the genes condition.
So the magnetic field is not the
factor. With a factor of 10, it does become important, as you also can see from that other plot. It does influence things, like for example here. they tend to avoid the smallest masses at the highest relative heat strength. And this is just measurements of the cores formed in the simulation. And it shows a very clear envelope relation with avoidance.
That's one effect in the magnetic field. Isn't there a separate effect which you have to, like, if you look at some of the clumps which you're forming stars from, and you calculate their angular momentum, there are two things that happen. Either the angular momentum could be sufficiently low that they could just collapse without any magnetic gradient, or they could still invoke a magnetic gradient.
I have the figure, but I didn't put it on the talk. So let's see if I can find it here.
Which one
could it be? I'm sorry, it's over on my machine in Copenhagen, but I have it on hard copy in my room, so you can come and look at it. Yeah.
So
sorry, what's the question?
About the fraction of binaries and clock rates.
Yes, we get this without assuming binary formation. But Paulus pointed out that this IMF does not allow any brown dwarfs. Okay? My opinion would be that the lack of smaller masses here is a numerical resolution thing. But with sufficient resolution, you can put even smaller masses, push them over the edge. But an alternative explanation that Paulus came up with was that if all stars form binaries with an equal distribution of mass between the two components, then almost nothing happens to these power law pieces. But what happens is you extend this towards smaller scales. I don't know if that's the explanation or if it's simply a question on numerical resolution. But certainly, the question about binary formation from a core is a field in itself. How you form stars once you have a core. That is what the people with adaptive mesh codes see as one of the fundamental problems that they're attacking.
When you call something a star, is it possible that something in that star is actually two stars?
Yes, it could change, for example. As long as that split into separate stars does not depend systematically on the mass, you would retain the same IMF.
I have a question. How about is actually connectivity in your simulations? Because when Eve asks you how do you actually get the IMF from your simulations, you made reference to IDL procedures and that find neighbors and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you always say that the important ingredient is the log-normal distribution of the density, which doesn't depend on connectivity.
Oh no, but these are separate issues, huh? The PDF and the distribution space are totally independent. If you know the PDF, you know nothing about the distribution space. And at least as far as I'm concerned,
the log-normal distribution determines the IMF.
I don't think it does. It's just a piece of the game. And really, the IMF is determined by the scaling of structures in turbulence. But the fact that you have an enormous range in density is why you can form stars. Because you form them out of those extremum points. So that those cores that are formed, they're all sampled from the right-hand side of the PDF, clearly.
Maybe you have some interest. Your visualization of the process is very close to what is now believed galaxy formation.
Uh-huh.
It's just the peaks in the density formation.
Okay. Right.
Even in those things, people have thought about the, some discussions of magnetic field suppressing small-scale structures in the same way that they're being suppressed here.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the suppression of the small scales in the magnetic field, I think there was some work on that in the galaxy formation, just about this argument about how ambient galaxy intergalactic magnetic field might play a role in the suppressive destruction of small scales, which was needed to match observations.
But to answer your question without having the figure, it is necessary to break those cores. And the magnetic field that is in the core would be a significant factor in breaking them further down to...
You mean after you had, quote, formed a star, there's still more to come that you don't discuss. Is that what you're saying?
After the cores have been formed on this scale, the smaller scale that we can resolve, they are then collapsing, gravitating, but they also carry a lot of magnetic field, at least some of them, and that field will help break the course, break the rotation of the course. But there's another much more trivial factor that I think would do the trick too. We must realize that this is a hierarchical scenario, that if we look at a dense structure at some scale, we could scale it to just about anything. The only difference is the Mach number, okay? So when we think about this collapsing core, it isn't really that nice and neat. It has infalling velocities that are not just totally pointing to one point. So you have shocks. You have things hitting each other on the way in, and that destroys angular momentum too, in a much more trivial way.
So there's a sub-layer of dynamics below a certain scale that requires more...
Yes, and I think there are at least two groups that are at the moment actually doing these types of computations. Last I heard about it, they were starting from very, very, very smooth conditions, and they were addressing the question, did people earlier get fragmentation because they had a bad code? And now they were doing this wonderful code, and we're using them to show that if you have very smooth conditions, you only form one star and not two. But really, this to start out from this mess as an initial condition and see what happens then.
Can you actually use the same dynamic range and then just actually do that simulation?
I could do a successive scaling. That's sort of a crude way of doing adaptive meshes. You stop and you simply rescale and then you follow it a while. Of course, yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. Could you say how long it takes a shock wave to cross one of your little density perturbations as compared to the collapse time from gravitation?
So these are typically severely unstable. They are severely unstable. They have a much shorter collapse time than sound travel time.
Basically, the gene condition, the sound crossing time compared to the
The box itself is gravitationally unstable. The gene strength of the box is such that the box itself is unstable. Are they? Okay.
By the way, when you have a strong shock wave hitting density, you just tear the whole thing apart.
To make that perhaps trivial, but still very, very important point, again, that I think I mentioned at some earlier point, if you have... one-dimensional compression, okay, and rho goes as 1 over L, and therefore the free fall time goes as L to the 1/2. If you have two, so this is 1D. If you have 2D, it goes as 1 over L squared, and therefore TFF goes as L, and that's neutral against sound speed. But if you have 3D, then TFF goes as L to the 3/2. And that shows that as long as it's isothermal, you can push things over the edge. By compressing it, you reduce its strength length. And eventually, gravity will win over... if someone's privately interested, I have a very neat IDL demo that I ran in class. Simply a sinusoidal velocity field compressing stuff. If you take it at half the sound speed, so just half, compression towards one point at half the sound speed. You can collapse an object that is twice as small as its Jeans length. You can beat the Jeans condition with a factor of 2. And with a Mach number 1, you can beat it down even further. Because you simply squish it until it gets unstable. Well, that can be done with 16 cubed on an IDL live on the screen. If anyone's interested, I'll do it after.
In your books, you don't take into account the ambient vorticity due to differential operation.
No. These boxes are so small compared to and the dynamical times here are of the order of a few million years. So in a few million years, this will not rotate much. So if we stop here, as far as most people are concerned, I can just start this thing for the ones that are interested. Yeah, it takes about 2 minutes. So here it is, the self-gravity experiment for class. So I put it, put it up at 0.9 Mach number, and a gravity parameter of 1.7, square root of 3, 1.73 is unstable here, so I put it at 1. 0.94, that should be enough. Everything else, I guess, is okay. Like so. So that's density now, and this is x velocity, y velocity, and z velocity.
What should we be looking for?
And
is this 2D?
This is 3D, 16 cubed. And this is now the maximum and minimum density.
And
then AVC convergence
condition?
No, it's just cosine. Cosine, and there's one, so there's one convergence point here. That's the convergence point, okay? And now you see the density, the max density has already gone up to, and this is dying now. This is the density cross section, and of course the code is crashing after this gets extreme. But that was enough, and this was 70% below critical. So the exercise for the students here is to repeat these various parameters and trace out this line where things collapse, actually. I think I could probably do it analytically as well. But then it's a refreshing exercise to look at real turbulence. It's very, very rare that you have perfectly aligned convergence in three dimensions. You typically have rotation as well, and that will stop the motion. So it certainly is true that you can form stop. So there's another one, which is the 3D ABC flow here, which we have real turbulence. And that can be run at 32 cubed. Well, reasonable evolution times. No. That doesn't belong in this.
Is decaying ABC flow that you're looking at?
It's a driven ABC flow. So you drive with an ABC forcing, and that gets becomes turbulent. Restore.
This is just a slice in three dimensions?
These are all the slices in three dimensions, actually. This is the density, and these are the actual...
No, it's three dimensions, you have just one plane. You're showing just one plane? Is
that I'm showing almost all, or every fourth plane or something. That should be enough to... I think I have the wrong data or something. Like so. So you see, even with a 32-cube thing, you can get something of a power spectrum. It's not quite Kolmogorov, but still it's pretty turbulent. And the RMS Mach number here is 1.8. And it has a PDF that looks a bit log normal. And it runs live, and you can even see it. Let's see. Yeah. You can even see these structures evolving in 3D. Oh, yeah. So.
Could you just offline tell us what is the order of accuracy of the code? Is it the
sixth order, fifth order?
I see. And how do you handle the shockwave thickness at Mach 5 and 10?
By compressive sensitive thing, much like the original one, Rick Meyer Morton, more or less. So wherever the wherever the div view is negative and large, yes, chosen such that shocks become barely resolved, and it's interesting that you
so sixth order away from the shocks.
No, sixth order in the shocks. Yes, it can. You can. Yes. So if you have a shock that looks like this.
Yeah.
You can easily pass a sixth order function through here. No problem.
No, but this part is resolved by artificial viscosity.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah.
So it's not exactly resolved. No.
But as far as the accuracy of the actual equations go, you're sixth order. No? But there is an artificial term in the equations that doesn't correspond to the real.
What I'm saying. Away from the shocks, you're sixth.
Yes, yeah. Compared to Euler or compared to Navier-Stokes. You can't be there. But it's interesting. You can actually compute sixth order. You don't have to reduce the accuracy, like some people do. They have a high order scheme out here, and then they have a low order scheme that takes care of the dissipation. But we find that it's much better to have explicit.
When you say that, you're doing it all one dimension. This is a remark about one dimensional, right? Because you compare it to one dimensional validation.
Yeah, we do. I could show you the shock tubes and so on.
Yeah.
But we have all kinds of.
What time do you want to go?
You didn't say that?
No, because I want to know what time you want to go.
Oh, okay. Well, it doesn't matter for me. Seven or something? Seven. What that was seven. That convenient?
Should we meet here then at 7? Yeah. What are you willing to the first this month?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's say 7.
Yeah, I'll try to make a reservation. And your family's
coming? Ah, yeah. Yeah, two people.
Two besides you.
Sorry?
Your wife and your son.
Yes. All right, yeah.
Sorry,
and let's see, was the B field being a tracer, or was it being computer-centric?
It's dynamic, yeah.
It's dynamic.
Yes, yeah. And we stagger so that we conserve the B exactly. We compute...
Do you have alpha and waves in this?
Yeah, if they want to be there, they're there.
So what do you mean stagger? How can it be exact?
We have electric fields on the edges of the mesh, okay? And B on faces.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you have exact Stokes' law on a face.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the B is conserved to within machine precision.
Yeah.
Without having to use the vector potential. And we found this approach very fruitful. We have explicit dissipation in the viscosity and in the resistivity.
Let's see, you have, since you said sixth order, but outside of the shocks you have regular viscosity. Is that true or not? Or is it Euler outside the shocks?
It's almost. We have a very weak viscosity outside of the shocks, as weak as possible, but you still need to have it there. For example, suppose that you transmit a sound wave, a very, very weak sound wave that doesn't steepen, just a linear sound wave, but you make it a square wave. Then you have dispersion.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, so you have to take care of the dispersion errors,
right.
And you have to damp them out. So we have to have a weak, but that is high order, fourth, so it's not second order, but fourth order, so it only affects the very lowest, highest wave numbers. And it works very well, actually. And we like this way because we don't have to mess with all those complicated TPM schemes and so on. The whole MHD part of this is about 100 lines of code. The rest is in operators. We can write it at a very high level.
higher level operators in terms of finite difference operators of a certain order? Is that what you mean?
Oh, I shouldn't do that. I should show you the actual code. Since I have it here. Just look at the screen. So the code for this particular experiment is MHD local. Oh. Okay. So I think it's actually computing still.
So let me just ask, if you turn off the magnetic field.
Oh shit, I have to close it.
And you ran a subsonic, would you get Kalmogorov?
Yes, with 128 cubed you get roughly Kolmogorov. Over one order of magnitude.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then it falls off the upper end as usual.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's sort of like this. Yeah. Look at this. This is k equals 12. Huh? And if you go a factor of 5 below that, you're close to inertial range. Huh? Okay. But now, look at this. Here in the actual code is the induction equation. That's it. Huh? 3 lines of code.
So how do I see higher order than that? Looks like there's 2 separate differences.
Yeah, so but this is a sixth order operator.
Sixth order operator.
Yeah. Okay. And by the staggering, because this is on an edge, and you stagger the derivative, you get down exactly on the face. So there's no interpolation needed.
Right.
You get the answer exactly where you want it. Mm-hmm. There is interpolation necessary in the U cross B, of course. So a fast mode wave is more accurate than an Alvian wave.
A fast
mode wave is more accurately represented than an Alvian wave because you have pressure, acceleration, induction, going around in a circle with no interpolations. Mm-hmm. But with an Alvian wave, you have an interpolation involved in the circle.
What circle? Oh, you mean the cycle?
Yes, yeah. Cycle. Yeah, the cycle from one time step to the next. Huh? And the interpolations are fifth order, so they reduce the accuracy a bit. Huh? But we like this because we can very, very easily manipulate the code. Huh?
Yes. Right.
And adopt it to some other case. Huh?
Right, right.
It may be a factor of 2 or 3 less efficient than the most fancy PPM versions. Huh? But who cares? Huh?
No, I mean, if you're getting this... If you're getting the higher order action, they don't get that.
No.
By definition, they don't get that.
No.
So they've lost.
Well, they have third order, that's...
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think I've seen anybody compute high Mach number stuff like you are with... that's right. You're not using the regular viscosity, you're using the numerical viscosity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you use regular viscosity, you have to make it very viscous.
Right. It can't do strong shocks.
No. If you do it, then the whole thing is just syrup. Huh?
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I said. I showed you that paper.
Yep.
That paper is very low Mach. It is Mach 1 plus something, right?
Yes.
Less Mach 0.8, but there are shocklets of Mach 1 point plus something.
Yes, because they have...
because they have the real viscosity.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Well, you'll hear my talk, and we have done stuff up to Mach 10, or we can trust some of it.
Okay.
And I can show you in great detail what I mean, 2D.
Yep.
We've not done any 3D, but 2D ICC.
Okay.
And 2D.
What resolution?